Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Yes, for people, the foreign exchange markets have a significant risk of loss. But for countries, currency is more, political. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 22nd of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, of all the topics that Economic Washington deals with at a policy level, few of them bring with them more wailing and gnashing of teeth than these two seemingly simple words. Currency manipulation. The subject comes up every 6 months. Treasury Department is required to put out a report listing those economies that are manipulating their currencies to gain competitive advantage. But really here, we are talking about one economy, right? China. And as we told you last week, the Treasury Department did not, repeat, not, say Beijing is manipulating its currency. But that did not end the wailing and the gnashing. Over the weekend, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said he might actually consider changing the rules the department uses to decide whether countries are playing fast and loose with the foreign exchange markets. So we asked Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, why all the Forex hubbub?
As far as current global economic issues go, currency manipulation, not super high on the list.
This is not something that very many countries have done historically, and not something many countries are doing today.
David Steinberg is a professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins. But if you worry, as the president does, that other countries sell more to us than we do to them, then you worry about the ways that exchange rates can make those foreign goods even more appealing. Matthew Goodman is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
There's a close relationship between currency and trade policies.
Thing is, Goodman says China isn't currently devaluing its currency for competitive advantage.
They don't, clearly meet the test of manipulation at the moment.
And anyway, the label just doesn't pack that much punch. Phil Swagel at the University of Maryland.
It's kind of a strange tool because if we deem China to be a currency manipulator, the result of that is then we have to have talks with China about it. But of course, we're talking with them already.
Then there's the politics. Derek Scissors with the American Enterprise Institute.
Remember, the president said he would call China a currency manipulator on day one. We've now gone through four rounds of reports where they haven't called him a currency manipulator. And, there are reasons for that, but that's not what he campaigned on.
Which could put him on the defensive on the next campaign trail. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
A detour now to personal finance and that all-important credit score that can weigh heavily on people's economic well-being. FICO, which is short for Fair Isaac Corporation, in case you didn't know it, rates your credit history and gives you said score. But the company said this morning it's coming up with a new number, a new product, if you will, something called Ultra FICO for people who don't have much of a credit history to begin with or who maybe didn't have the greatest credit in the past. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more now on who stands to gain from that.
If you don't have a credit history, it's kind of hard to get a credit score. Like, it's hard to get a grade in a class if you've never taken any of the tests. So what FICO is doing instead with Ultra FICO is looking at other information besides your credit history to figure out how creditworthy you are.
That includes not having a history of negative balances, having savings, and transacting responsibly.
Sally Taylor is Scores Vice President at FICO. She says you have to volunteer this information willingly. It's not automatic. There are 53 million people in the U.S. who don't have a credit score, students or immigrants, for example.
This score will tap into another 10 to 15 million, we estimate, of that 53 million.
That's, of course, millions more people for lenders to lend to and for FICO to score. Taylor also says this will raise the credit scores for some people. Jack Gillis is executive director of the Consumer Federation of America.
The folks that will benefit the most from this are those folks who have marginal credit scores or who don't really have much credit.
Better scores can save people money. They affect your insurance, your car loan, your mortgage. Now, the question for any new type of credit score, though, is it accurate? Jonathan Glowacki is a principal at consulting firm Milliman.
So it's very easy to create credit scores when the economy is going well and defaults are very low. where the rubber's going to hit the road is really when we hit the next rough patch.
The next recession is when you find out which loans should not have been made. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Ain't that always the way? On Wall Street today, thy name is volatility. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are, in case you somehow haven't been keeping track, 15 days until the midterm elections. And while acknowledging that past performance is no guarantee of future results, if the next 2 weeks are anything like the past couple of months, hoo boy, is a lot of political money going to be spent. The Center for Responsive Politics figures $5 billion from all sources is going to wind up being spent on the 2018 congressional elections. A lot of it coming from, well, shall we say, the upper end of the income distribution. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
One of the reasons there's so much money flowing into these midterm elections is because billionaires are lavishing more of their cash on politicians.
This is something that sort of arose out of enormous fortunes being made over the last few decades.
That's Stanford political scientist Adam Bonica. He found that the total wealth of the Forbes 400 jumped 11-fold since 1982, and the amount wealthy people spend on politics has gone up in proportion. Historically, he says,
pretty clear that there was a lot more money coming from very wealthy conservatives.
Like casino mogul Sheldon Adelson. He's worth $34 billion, and he's a staunch supporter of Republicans and pro-Israel issues. After giving Donald Trump $25 million for his election, Adelson watched from the front row as the president celebrated the opening of an embassy in Jerusalem. This year, Adelson and his wife have ponied up $87 million to conservative groups and candidates. But lately, Bonica says many billionaires are leaning another way.
And over time, it's been trending pretty clearly towards more money going to the Democrats.
Conservative candidates have earned more billionaire donations, but data from the Center for Responsive Politics show Democrats are catching up. Bonica says that's because a lot of newer billionaires come from more liberal places, like Silicon Valley. Dustin Moskovitz, the billionaire co-founder of Facebook, gave over $5 million to groups like MoveOn.org and a group dedicated to winning Senate races. Others say the polarized political climate over the last 2 years has led more people in general to contribute.
I feel this is an emotional need for people to engage.
That's Jenna Narayanan at Next Gen America. That's the political action committee run by one of the biggest Democratic donors, Tom Steyer, the hedge fund billionaire from San Francisco. You might know Steyer from his controversial ad campaign to impeach the president, which hasn't been uniformly popular with Democrats.
A Republican Congress once impeached a president for far less. Yet today,
Steyer's political groups are spending $110 million on liberal causes. And East Coast billionaires are spending a lot, too. Boston-based hedge fund manager Seth Klarman recently announced he'd donate $20 million to help elect Democrats after years of supporting the GOP. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg pledged $100 million to help elect Democrats. That could prove useful as Bloomberg eyes a Democratic presidential bid in 2020. Contributions like Bloomberg's are pretty easy to track, but then there's what's known as dark money.
So we're seeing the spending side, but we don't necessarily know who is actually behind it in a lot of the cases.
Anna Masolia researches dark money at the Center for Responsive Politics. A huge chunk of the spending goes to advertising, and depending on what the ads say, she says their funders don't always have to be disclosed.
So it makes it hard to tell whether it's a billionaire spending or a corporation or anyone else.
She says Democrats are collecting more dark money from donors in recent years, perhaps to avoid the stigma associated with big money in politics. But she says high-profile billionaires tend to operate in the open.
As they get more name recognition, their groups at least get more disclosure, whether that be us piecing together the puzzles or their reaction to that being that they do start disclosing a bit more.
After all, it doesn't hurt if the politicians you helped elect know that you backed them during the campaign. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
One of the lessons of the financial crisis is that timing can be everything. We've been doing a series this year about what the economic near collapse of a decade ago and the recession that followed did to this economy and to the people who live and work in it. It's called How We Changed, our series is. And today, Carlos Frias, now the food editor at the Miami Herald, but as you'll hear 10 years ago, also an author.
In the summer of 2006, Fidel Castro got sick. He disappeared from power for that stretch where he was supposed to have surgery, and everybody wanted to get into Cuba. At the time, I was a sports writer for the Palm Beach Post, and they needed somebody on staff who spoke Spanish, you know, Cuban, which was kind of like a bonus because you kind of understood the context, and they needed it right away. They wanted me to go to Cuba to report about Castro's handing over power and what the island looked like. And while I was there, I had an editor who I call kind of like the father of my writing life. He said, tell us the story of your family. So that was it. That was the opportunity to start doing that. I came back and I wrote a 5-day series for the Post that was really well received. And it caught the attention of a publisher at Simon & Schuster. And it kind of took off from there. November of 2008 is when the book drops. The other thing that drops in 2008 is all of publishing. All of a sudden, it became perilous to be a writer. Unfortunately, the book kind of died on the vine. There was a book tour. There was a Spanish version of the book. Neither of those things happened. And it was heartbreaking to not be able to see it really find its way. Because of the economy, that voice was muted, if not silenced. 10 years later is a lot for an economy to change. And kind of out of the blue, you know, Penguin gets a copy of the book in English and says, we really like this. And they buy the Spanish rights. Like, I didn't see a penny from it, which is unfortunate. But the beauty of it is it opened it up to a whole new audience. And like, as a writer, really, at the end of the day, all you want is for people to read your writing. That, to me, was the end of that story.
We've got a picture of Carlos Frias on our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM. Check it out. His book, by the way, is called Take Me With You. But while you're at our Instagram, if I could back up for a second, leave us a comment. Let us know how the financial crisis changed you with the hashtag #HowWeChanged. Coming up.
So yeah, as you can see, it's pretty normal. There's a lot of people around. No one really bats an eyelash.
Just another day delivering pot. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, a little bit mixed on Wall Street today. Dow Industrials off about 0.5%, 126 points, 25,317. The S&P 500 off 0.4%. That's 11 points, 27.55. The NASDAQ, though, added 0.25%, 19 points. Wrapped up the day at 74.68. A big drop in financials was one reason for the mixed results. Bank of America withdrew 3.3%. Goldman Sachs and Wells Fargo each lost about 2.3%. JP Morgan, JPM, down 1.4%. Energy stocks were another drag. Shares of oilfield services company Halliburton dribbled down 3%. ExxonMobil lost about 1% or so. On the plus side, just because you got to have some good news, tech stock shares of Amazon powered up 1.4%. Twitter chirped up 1.2%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 3.19%. You're listening to Marketplace. Sign up for our daily e-newsletter by October 31st, and you could be in for a Halloween treat. We're giving away 10 Marketplace treat bags filled with some great swag, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what goes into bringing you the program every single day, a rundown that I will sign personally. Subscribe today at Marketplace.org for your chance to win, and good luck.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. You have heard perhaps of the Sinclair Broadcast Group, a behemoth of a local television conglomerate that gets attention every now and then for its top-down and very conservative political agenda that winds up on the air in dozens of local markets across the country. There is, though, a business model story that goes along with Sinclair, how it got so big and so influential. Sheila Kolhatkar, one of our Friday regulars, I should say, she wrote about it for The New Yorker magazine, where she is a staff writer. Sheila, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to be here, Kai.
So maybe the place to start, actually, is just with a little primer on who or what Sinclair is, because it's been a little while, a couple of months anyway, since this company's been in the news.
Sinclair is the largest owner of broadcast television stations in the U.S., and a lot of people are not terribly familiar with them the way they hear about CNN and NBC and other big networks. Sinclair owns 192 stations in 89 markets. So they're enormously influential. They're seen by a lot of people, but they're largely outside the coastal media bubble.
Back up to that size thing, because that is relevant in a lot of ways for the context of this article, because there are regulations and considerations about who can own what media-wise, right?
Right. Well, regulation of television has changed over time and it has loosened over time. But in general, there are a lot of restrictions around media ownership for reasons of preserving competition in local markets, mm-hmm. and also because diverse points of view and diverse sources of news are considered to be sort of fundamental to maintaining a free and open democracy. Mm-hmm.
So dig down into this a little bit and give me, I guess, maybe the first one of these that Sinclair did back in the day was in Baltimore, and explain how they got around the rules, I suppose, is the question I'm looking for.
So what they did was they would acquire a competitor station. The FCC would say, well, you need to divest, you need to sell one of these stations in order to comply with the regulations and the laws. But then they came up with a very clever trick with the help of their lawyers, and they would just simply divest the second station to a shell company run by sort of a business associate or a member of the Smith family, which is the family that mm-hmm. controls Sinclair. You know, so they would be able to say to the FCC that they sold the station, but in fact, the station was still not really independent. Mm-hmm. And then they would sign an agreement that would give them the right to supply all of the programming to the station.
Let's get the Sinclair response in here. You asked them, you know, how did you guys get away with this in essence? And they say their line has been for many years, we have met all legal requirements, right?
Yes. They did manage to stay within the strict interpretation mm-hmm. of the law, although they violated the spirit of the right. law, one could say. But yes, what they did was strictly legal. But it was brazen. It was pushing right. the line for sure.
So to the other half of that question then, why did the Federal Communications Commission let Sinclair do this so many times?
There's no simple answer to that. I mean, the FCC comes under a lot of criticism for allowing too much consolidation has been a problem under both Democratic and Republican administrations. They have allowed a number of enormous monopolies to form. Now, I should say that in the late 90s, the FCC did investigate Sinclair for this sort of fraudulent divestiture strategy. They ended up finding that Sinclair had violated some of these rules and they were not making good faith, truly independent divestitures. And they fined the company, brace yourself, $40,000, which is really not a lot of money to a large corporation like Sinclair.
A word here in defense of the Federal Communications Commission. Sinclair has wanted to buy Tribune Media for a while. They had a deal. And just a number of months ago, but recently in relative terms, the chairman of the FCC, Ajit Pai, said, in essence, I'm not going to let that happen.
The Tribune merger was sort of a fascinating little window into the business and regulatory environment that has sprung up under President Trump. There was this real sense that the merger would just get waved through because Trump is a big supporter of Mr. Smith and of Sinclair, and he was tweeting positive statements about the company. And several weeks ago, Ajit Pai announced, well, we're not going to approve this deal. We have major concerns. And he effectively killed the deal, referred it to a legal hearing within the FCC, which sort of dooms it. But what we've learned since then is Sinclair was basically behaving in such a way that it was a foregone conclusion. They did not even make minimal effort to appease their regulators and get their deal approved.
And they had such success for such a long period of time that they figured the odds were in their favor.
The trick had worked in the past. Yeah. And a number of regulatory experts I spoke with said, well, it's sort of one thing to try and pull off that trick with the sham divestitures when you're a much smaller company. Yeah. But once you're the largest company in the country and you're about to become even larger, the government's going to take a closer look. And even in this incredibly friendly environment, what they were trying to do was so brazen that the FCC had to put a stop to it.
Sheila Kolhatkar, staff writer for The New Yorker, writing most recently about the Sinclair Broadcasting Company. Also, you hear her every now and then on a Friday with us. Sheila, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
On the theory that no industry, no matter how new or how potentially big it is immune from disruption, cast a glance now toward recreational marijuana, if you would. It's legal in 9 states, including here in California, home to what is widely expected to be the biggest legal recreational pot industry in the country. And this is not unrelated, also home to much of the technological innovation in this economy right now. David Weinberg reports on Uber, but for pot.
It's after dark on a Friday night. A woman who goes by the name Geisha is circling a luxury hotel in downtown Los Angeles. She's looking for a middle-aged woman with long gray hair, capri pants, and a pink and white checkered top.
Hi, I'm pulling up in front of the Westin. Where are you standing?
She stops in front of the hotel and ignores the bellhop who's trying to get her to pull forward. The woman she's looking for walks up to the car and hands Geisha a $100 bill.
Your total is $85. And I gave you a free gift.
Geisha hands the woman a white paper bag full of marijuana, and the woman tells her to keep the change. Marijuana is still illegal at the federal level, so transactions like this are usually cash only. And these days, no big deal.
So yeah, as you can see, it's pretty normal. There's a lot of people around. No one really bats an eyelash. Just another day in sunny California.
Now, a month later, Geisha, whose real name is Marianne Cotan, is out of a job. The dispensary she worked for, the Downtown Patient Group, suddenly stopped its delivery service. They would not comment for this story, but the margins for pot delivery are tight. Drivers are not gig workers like they are for Lyft and Uber. State law requires them to be W-2 employees making at least minimum wage and getting benefits. And digital disruption is also changing the industry. One of the state's biggest players in the delivery space is a Silicon Valley startup called Ease.
We are at Ease's Los Angeles headquarters in Venice Beach.
David Mack is the Senior Vice President of Public Affairs for Ease. The company raised more than $50 million from investors, which helps pay for this office space in a luxurious home once owned by Angelica Houston. He points out employees sitting behind a wall of giant computer monitors.
So the orders come through the Ease platform. The orders are then routed to a local licensed dispensary partner.
Once that business receives an order, Ease software dispatches a driver who is an employee of the dispensary, not Ease.
Last count, I asked earlier today, there are approximately 1,200 drivers with dispensaries that are on the Ease platform.
One thing you will never see at Ease is marijuana. The company does not have a state pot license and never touches the product to stay clear of federal law enforcement. Max says Ease makes money by charging dispensaries a fee and taking a percentage of every sale. For dispensaries that don't have a lot of foot traffic, delivery can be crucial. But dispensary owner Jared Kylo isn't sold. He met with Ease and was alarmed by the business agreement they offered.
So it kind of looked like we're going to take every part of your business and take no risks because they don't currently hold a license. So it looked like a Trojan horse.
Kylo says Ease only wanted to sell products it endorses and limited his access to customer data. But other dispensaries see Ease as an engine for growth.
You know, back in the early days, it was, you know, really just we had 2 people in the morning, 2 people in the evening.
Sky Siegel is a manager for Perennial, which now has about 170 part-time drivers on its payroll since contracting with Ease.
On the average day, we service anywhere from 300 to 400 orders in Los Angeles right now, and the number is growing every day.
Now Ease is lobbying for a new law that would allow drivers to sell products directly from their vehicles. In Los Angeles, I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Just final note on the way out today, a summary from the president this morning with lots of helicopter noise in the background, we should say, so we apologize for that. But anyway, a summary of part of his most recent stump speech, the part where he says he's going to get another tax cut done before the elections in 2 weeks. How is he going to do that?
We're putting in a resolution sometime in the next week or a week and a half, 2 weeks.
Not for nothing, but the Internal Revenue Code doesn't get changed by resolution. Anyway, the president went on.
We're giving a middle income tax reduction of about 10%. We're doing it now for middle income people. This is not for business. This is for middle. That's on top of the tax decrease that we've already given.
Congress, by the way, which would have to pass any new tax cut, is in recess until after the election, which the president did finally kind of seem to get.
No, no, no. I'm going through Congress. We'll be submitted. We won't have time to do the vote. We'll do the vote later. We'll do the vote after the election.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only... Come on, you thought of the same thing, right? Love me some Schoolhouse Rock, right? All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's off about a half percent today, 126 points. NASDAQ added a quarter percent, 19 points. S&P 500 went the other way, down 0.4%, 11 points on that particular index. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.